All right, so we're ready to get started with our final session. And there is no reading for this session. So we'll go ahead and call forward Brother Ken. This is session 6, the seasons of marriage.
Well, I have to begin with a disclaimer. I didn't bother putting the projector back up. The disclaimer is, you know the graph we showed yesterday about our family and how it matched exactly with the communication line? And it was, I think I said the source of the graph was tongue-in-cheek applications. That graph wasn't a genuine depiction of our family. We didn't really take all of the factors and load them in at one end of a machine and have a graph come out at the other end of a machine. So if I left anyone with the wrong impression, that was just for illustration purposes only. Because I've had people come up to me and they, so that's where your children were born, so there's the Jacob cliff and the Peter cliff. And so anyways, so how this afternoon is going to work is we're going to spend the first portion talking about what the book refers to as the spring season of life. And then we've got a couple of activities to do. And then we'll deal with the summer season of life, where we get more into raising children. This first section of the is more devoted to those couples who have just been married or you're still in the first, 5 to 6 years of your marriage, maybe a bit longer, but you haven't entered to the phase where you have children yet. So that's where these words are directed towards. Most of what we say is in the notes, so you can follow along there if you like. But I've got the wrong notes in front of me. So here we go. Does everybody have the handouts? We should have gotten those out to you. You can set those aside. You can put them in your binder if you like. There is one part of the handouts we'll be using as an exercise in a few minutes, so don't do away with them altogether. But for those who are just married in the last 5 years, maybe the last couple of years, again, we don't know what your personal circumstances are. Hopefully you've come to see that if romantic love could alone, produce the transformed characters that God needs, there would be millions of marriages out there in the world where the people would be transformed. So don't be surprised if in the swirling, romantic, thrilling environment that you experienced in your courtship, all of a sudden went away after you were married. It's not that you don't love each other less, as we said on Friday night, I think it was, or maybe early Saturday. What happens is, once you're through the honeymoon phase, the human nature sets in because you now have to deal with it on a regular basis. So that at some point after the honeymoon period, there's a change that takes place in your relationship, and nobody comes and knocks on your door and says, okay, honeymoon phase is over, you're now entering the next phase. All of a sudden you realize we're having kind of uncomfortable discussions. You might even call them arguments, but I don't want to say argument because married couples don't argue, do they? And then you have that, full-blown, we just didn't get along in that conversation. And you start to wonder, does this mean our marriage is coming apart? And because you're now having to deal with the flesh, 24/7. You didn't see that in the courtship phase, but you begin to see that now. It was always there. The human nature and the tendencies and the character flaws were always there. You just didn't have to deal with it during that dreamy, idyllic period, of courtship where it doesn't matter what your parents say, it doesn't matter what your friends say, it's just so lovely. Tony is just so marvelous. Did you know he likes to comb his hair on both sides of his head? And your friends are looking at you like, wow, you are really over the moon on this one, aren't you? But it's good. I don't mean to demean that. That those courtship years are good. They just aren't they just aren't sufficient to carry through into a marriage and deal with the issues that come up. So the warts of your spouse, the one who 3 years ago you started courting, and then 2 years ago you got engaged, and then a year ago you got married, the warts have now appeared. And now that you're living in the same house and you see the person over and over again, and hopefully you can see it's not a bad thing, it's a good thing. It's a good thing if the aim of both of you is to have your characters transformed, because no one ever married a perfect spouse who didn't need transformation. People who don't need transformation don't need marriage, and that's why in the kingdom it won't be part of God's constitution for those who have been made immortal. So don't view the warts of your spouse in a negative light. It's all part of God's wisdom and purpose behind the godly marriage relationship. And part of the marriage is designed, hopefully you now see, is to get rid of those warts. And recognize, you know, you yourself are not the perfect person, because your spouse has now begun to see your own warts in this first early period of our marriage. And what better person than to deal with your warts than the person whom you love and the person who loves you. So I refer to warts. You can use your own term if you don't like that term, but it's those blemishes, those character flaws that, yeah, they were always there, you just didn't necessarily see them. All right, so now that we're not surprised, we've left the honeymoon phase, we're now into this wart recognition phase, or call it what you like. It's not because your love has waned, it's not because your spouse doesn't love you any less. It's because you're now having to deal with what God had intended to be dealt with in the marriage environment. In that great enemy of the godly marriage, the human nature, is now very prominent in the relationship, and it didn't used to be. So the first time you quarrel or you spar, it can be pretty unnerving, especially for the woman. You know, you didn't have any experience with this in courtship, or if you did, it seemed to be, you know, much less. But now you're dealing with this head on. So this is why, if you can spend this time, these early years of marriage before the kids come along, if you can spend this time to become to strengthen the spiritual component of your relationship during these early years, it will only serve you well in the years ahead, depending on how much time you have together and before the Lord returns. But you can talk to any of the parents here who have children. Once the children come into the relationship, everything changes. It changes for good, because that's how God designed it, but you no longer have the time and the ability and the flexibility, once children arrive, to grow together spiritually like you do once the children come. Because once the children are here, then they take a lot of our time, a lot of our energy and our efforts, and you can't just go off and spend an evening together. You know, if depending on the age of the child and how much, you know, how demanding they are, it may be very difficult to get even a couple of hours of time alone, where you're not having to deal with everything else that life is bringing upon you, just to have meaningful time together. So it's critical that your spiritual component be growing in these early years. At the very time you see that you're discovering the warts, so the both things are happening, should be happening at the same time. You're discovering the warts in each other, and hopefully you are growing spiritually. And the spiritual growth of your relationship can be strong and vibrant, and it can counteract that ugliness of the flesh. And you see, if you don't have the strong spiritual component growing in your relationship, and all you have is the discovery of more and more warts that don't go away, then that's where that begins to cause trouble for the younger couples. And when I speak of warts, I'm talking about those points of, not just those points of agitation or irritation. You know, I had to learn to put the toilet seat down, just like I think every husband in the room had to learn to put the toilet seat down. You know, that's a point of irritation. And it's just easier to learn, husbands. Trust me. I tried the route of not learning. It doesn't work. You know, and I don't mean to minimize that, ladies. There's lots of things that we can do for each other that helps remove the irritation. But sometimes the warts are beyond just those things of irritation. You know, there could be things in your spouse that have deeper roots, and you know, so you deal with some of the warts include the aspects of you know, a temper or honesty or whatever it is. You know, that also comes to the surface, and you have to begin to deal with these. And it's sometimes can be a very stressful environment for the relationship, because the relationship is still young and tender, and you know, you have to learn to take each other's interests into account. So if one spouse early on in the relationship just like to hit the other spouse on the shoulder as a way of showing how they had affection for the other spouse, and the spouse receiving the light hit on the shoulder didn't appreciate it, you know, and said, you know, I don't appreciate it when you hit me on the shoulder. Yeah, but I'm just showing my love to you when I do that. You know, you got to learn that, that's not a good practice to continue, because if you keep going for 4, 5, 6 months with that and you don't change, it can become more than just friction. So deal with the points of agitation out of love, and change your habits. And that applies to the toothpaste, and it applies to all those other things. You know, fellas, if you had the habit of just throwing your clothes on the bedroom floor because that's what you've done for the last 5 years and that is a point of agitation, then don't do that anymore. Change. That's the kind of thing you can change in a heartbeat. And you're not changing because, you know, she made you do it. You're changing out of love, because we change our habits for each other out of love. So deal with those points. It's part of submitting to one another in the fear of God, as Ephesians 5 speaks of. So the warts can also include the selfishness, the pride, the vanity, the inconsiderateness, the covetousness. You know, those are the biggies. And those aren't just warts that have no impact on the relationship. Those are warts that God has been dealing with already before you came onto the scene. And he hasn't been able to be successful in removing those warts from your spouse's character. So recognize that you are now entering the picture, you know, after God has already been at work in this. And now your role, as we saw in the exhortation, is to be assisting what God has already been trying to do. And some of those warts run pretty deep, and they're not going to go away. So be prepared to work with your spouse and helping them in those issues. That's where we need to be forbearing and compassionate on the one hand, but we certainly don't turn a blind eye and ignore things on the other. And don't let frustrations with the warts get away with you in the relationship. It's not going to be helpful in either way. Now, by this, I hope you don't interpret my comments to mean, you know, so you want to start making a list of all the warts of your spouse, and by the time you get home, you will have told your spouse, yeah, I was told to make a list of all the warts, so here they are. Now, that's not what we're looking for. What we're looking for is a sensitivity and appreciation that, you know, you're going to have these situations come up in your relationship, and there are going to be things that trouble you personally that may not trouble others, and there's also going to be some legitimate issues in your spouse's character that need to be addressed. And this is all part of the for better or for worse part of the vows. So any questions about the warts? If you have any, you can talk to some of the older members, the ones who have been married for, you know, 10 years or more probably, and they can tell you their own stories to validate that. In the notes, we've also included, for those who are younger, married, you know, fewer years of marriage, we've included a section on finances. Finances don't need to be a problem for marriages in the early years, but they can be a problem, especially if a couple begins to spend more money than they have. And if you take the proper steps on the front end, then you can avoid some problems that otherwise might creep into your relationship. So if your finances are tight, it can be very helpful to keep track of them. And you keep track of them by, you know, keeping track of everything that you spend anytime you buy something over 30 or 40 or 20 or whatever the amount is. This is an area where it's helpful to have lots of communication. If you're in a situation in your marriage where finances are tight, if you're not in that situation, some of this may not apply to you. But it's always helpful for both spouses to be in agreement, to be on the same page, so to speak, on where your money will be spent. That way it helps, you know, eliminate the surprises. Husband doesn't come home and find out his wife spent $500 for a new sofa that didn't know we needed. And, you know, a couple days go by and he drives up with a new quad. Didn't know we needed. You can buy these things, you know, you got plastic in your wallet that lets you buy them, and you can go well beyond your means. We've listed in the notes, you know, the biblical references. We're not going to go through those, but, you know, the Bible gives good counsel on finances and expenses. But by talking these things over ahead of time and agreeing ahead of time on what your major purchases are going to be, you don't surprise each other, you don't let each other down. You may have to delay some things. You may have to choose this and not this. But do all that proactively. Do all that conversation. Have all those conversations before the purchases are made, because you can alleviate a lot of the problems and the difficulties that otherwise would creep up. We've given you an example of what a possible budget might look like. It's fairly simple. You basically have income on the one hand, the money that's coming in from employment. You have expenses on the other hand. You know, this isn't you don't need to keep track of every nickel and dime that you spend. You just want to have an idea of what's coming in and what's going out. Because if you have a good idea on what's coming in, which usually you can anticipate the income for the family better than the expenses. Because with expenses, sometimes you have unexpected expenses. You got a major car repair, you know, a repair to the house, or you got a medical condition that you weren't anticipating, or your parents on one side or the other need some help that you hadn't anticipated, or your brother or whatever. So sometimes the expenses can be a bit elusive, but the more you're able to keep track of this proactively, the better position that you'll be in, and you can avoid some of the difficulties. You're encouraged to, you know, try to save some money each month if you're able to, because that helps set aside money for these unexpected expenses. So really, the purpose of the budgeting and all that is to save you some grief and turmoil in your relationship. We've given you some simple guidelines and rules to follow in financing. Number one, be united in your planning and purchasing. You know, agree ahead of time on what you're going to buy in terms of major purchases that you don't normally purchase. It doesn't necessarily have to be the husband that keeps track of the finances. In our case, Sister Diane does all the financial work in our family. You know, I went to school and got a degree in accounting, but, you know, you don't need an expertise to do this. It's somebody's got to keep track of what's coming in and keep track of what's going out. So whatever works for your situation. Stick to your budget. You know, if you agree this is how much we're going to spend every month, you know, on these things, then stick to your budget. There's think of it as financial standards to live by. No sense in having standards that we agree to and then we end up abandoning the standards because something enticing comes along and, you know, after we go, we go after it. If you need to deviate from the budget, then sit down together and say, okay, we should... We're going to agree to do this change because of the pressing need. Be understanding of the other person's need is another one. In some cases, you know, you don't know it at the time, but you have a spendthrift. A spendthrift is one who can't pass up a sale, you know, even for the things you don't need. Oh, look at this. That's on sale. I'll take one of those. And then you have a spendthrift who marries a miser, who doesn't spend even when you do need. So you put those together and you can have a clash of financial expectations. It makes for interesting conversation, interesting dinner time conversation, but just be aware that based on your background and your outlook, it can have an impact on this part of your relationship. So you need to find a happy medium, or there will be unhappy consequences. And this is, again, where you need to have open and frank communication with each other so you can eliminate a lot of unnecessary squabbles. That's a big piece of the whole finance picture. You're trying to talk about things ahead of time and plan things ahead of time so you can eliminate the squabbles. There, if something happens unexpectedly and you're put under a tight situation, at least you tried to do what was right. You both face the situation together and say, we'll make the best of it, instead of one of you creating a problem for the family financially that might have been avoided. Don't spend more than you make. It sounds like a no-brainer, but with credit cards today, we get phone calls. You know, we're even on that 1-800 don't call us list. We still get the phone calls from people. I don't know where they get our number and how they find things out. In fact, you know, if you probably know this sooner than I did, but you click on something on the internet. You know, we're thinking of buying a new plant for our kitchen table. Then for the next week, you get all these advertisements for plant for this and plant for that. And you say, where did all this come from? Well, you happen to be interested in this issue over here, and somebody back there behind the computer wall saw that, and now they just start targeting all these things at us. And they do it for a reason, because they know if they try enough times, they're going to have some people respond. So, be sure. It's a biblical principle. And again, we've given you the references. As a rule of thumb, if you use a credit card, which most of us do, just make sure you can pay off your debt by the end of the month, so you're staying abreast of that. Learn to be content with what you have. Again, several scriptural references. Don't allow the marketing gurus to convince you need more than what God has provided you with. That's how they make their living. That's why they advertise. But don't permit them to teach you to love money and what money can buy, because that's not going to be helpful. Sister Diane tends to use the word tactilian to describe a person who isn't happy unless they've made a purchase. And that was a new word for me, but you see that from time to time, especially with the older members in our ecclesias. It seems to be an aspect of some of their characters. And I'm now talking about the ones up there in the years. Be generous to others. And giving to others, again, the references, give to God. Tithing is a biblical principle. I'm not here to tell everybody you should be tithing, but, it's a biblical principle to set aside something for God every week. That's why we have the collection, as part of the memorial meeting. And because in reality, our money is not ours. It's God's, and it's put on loan to us. If you run into trouble, get help. If you run into trouble, get help. And that's true any aspect of our marriage. There are brethren available who can help you confidentially. And by that I mean they can sit down with you, and if you're not sure how the budgeting process works, and in January you had this much debt, and now it's April and you got this much debt, you don't know what happened, get the help. That's all. Because somebody can sit down and teach you the skills and show you how to, move in the right direction. And it will be very helpful for your marriage. If you don't get the help, then come September, you're going to be in a worse situation than you were in April. And now it begins to really tear at the fabric of your relationship. So don't let finances tear down the oneness of your relationship. If it's putting a strain on your relationship, and you're the cause of that because you're spending more than you should or whatever, find the resolution for this, because otherwise it can be very, very destructive. And the last item for the, those in the earlier years of your marriage, the best thing you can do spiritually is, before the children come along, is to be a good disciple. It's the time where you want to develop the good Bible habits of doing the Bible readings, of attending the ecclesial activities. Go out of your way, if you don't have children in your relationship, to be able to, visit the older members of the ecclesia, participate in the various ecclesial activities. But what you're looking to do is, create a God-centered home, just the two of you, where you develop good, godly, spiritual habits that you hold each other accountable to, because that will serve you well if and when God blesses you with children, because once you add children into that mix, That is not typically where the godly standards of a couple are increased. That's where the godly standards of the couple are challenged because of the additional factor that children introduce into that relationship. Children are wonderful. If you're not sure of that, see the little babies that we have around here this weekend. Children are wonderful, but they just add additional challenges to the relationship that you didn't have beforehand. So I don't want to in any way demean children. It's just take advantage of the time that you have together. In terms of the operational needs of the kids, you can't prepare for that. You know, you'll have to learn, as all young parents do, you know, how to change diapers 2 or 3 times a day. And you will find out which store is open at 2 o'clock in the morning because you've now run out of diapers. You know, I thought you were going to buy them. No, you were going to buy them. And when you run out of diapers, that's a crisis, okay? So you got to find some place at 2 o'clock in the morning because you can't wait till 8 o'clock in the morning. So, I mean, all those operational issues, you're going to have to work through. You can't really read a book on any of that. You know, and sometimes your plans are going to change. You're going to be going out the door to meeting at 9 o'clock, and then something happens. The child is sick or whatever, and one of you is not going to go to a meeting today because it just isn't going to be possible. But prepare yourself spiritually and take advantage of the time. So that's the few thoughts we had on the early years of marriage. If you will now want to direct your attention to our two exercises. We're going to do two during this period. The first is coming to understand how you were raised as a child and how that can impact your marriage. So your family upbringing plays and can play a major influence in your marriage. How your parents treated each other can have a major impact, for good or for bad, on your own marriage relationship because that left an impression upon you. It doesn't mean if one parent mistreated another parent that you're going to turn around and mistreat your spouse. That's not what we're saying. It's just be aware of how you were raised can have an impact on your own marriage relationship. And I'll share an experience with you from our own family. You know, my dad was raised in a home where his parents were at odds with each other. They were in the truth, but the way I categorize it is my grandmother had a missing piece. I'm not a psychologist or a psychologist. I just see that at different times people have missing pieces which inhibit their ability to get along with other people, as most of us normally get along with each other. And that can be a source of agitation and irritation. And many people observed it, but my grandfather bore the brunt of it. And my dad witnessed this as he was growing up. And even into the later years, he had to deal with that situation. So I can remember as a teenager, we lived in Detroit. My grandparents would move from Florida. Sorry, they wouldn't move. They would visit us from Florida. My grandmother would stay with us, and my grandfather would stay in a hotel. They both lived together in Florida, but when they came to visit us, they didn't both stay in the house because my parents did not want the grandkids to have to witness the bickering. So they had this arrangement where Grandpa would stay at a nearby hotel. Now, as a child, as a teenager even, you're not quite sure what all this means. It's not until you get older that you look back and you put the pieces together and you have a chance to talk to your dad and find out what was going on. Now, in that case, he lived with that and he had to deal with that even late into his life. But in his case, having witnessed that, it had the opposite positive influence on how he treated my mother. Because what he saw, he wanted to make sure it was not going to be replicated in his own relationship. So I don't want to leave anyone with the impression that if you saw something negative when you were growing up, you know, it's now doomed for you. It's just be aware that how we are raised can have an impact on what we bring to the relationship. So if we witnessed our parents fighting verbally from time to time in order to settle disagreements, we may think, well, that's just what you do. You have a good old fashioned, verbal slugfest from time to time, because that's what parents do. That's not what parents do in a godly marriage relationship. Or you if your mother typically ridiculed your father behind his back, and you are the daughter of that mother who typically ridiculed the father behind his back, you may bring to the marriage, well, that's just what mothers do. They wait for the dad to go out of the room, and then they turn to the kids and they do whatever they do. So just be aware that if that is how you were raised, it may have had an influence on you. You may have been a son whose father was very stern and very unloving, because he understood, well, I supply my family economically, and that's my responsibility. I don't know anything about this emotional stuff. I leave that to my wife. But I provide for my family and I protect my family. Well, if you're raised in that environment, you have to recognize that's a very unbalanced approach to being a father. So just be aware of these situations. And the purpose of this exercise then is to allow the two of you to explore and discuss what your past was. It's just 5 minutes for one, then 5 minutes for the other, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on it. But turn to page 80, if you would, in your book. We're only doing parts B and C. This is exercise number 3, reflect on your upbringing. We're actually starting on page 80. So there's no title to the exercise on page 80. It was back on page 79. So there's a series of questions. Consider the following questions and tick the relevant boxes. First, you're doing it for your mother or stepmother, and then you're doing it for your father or stepfather. So you're going to go through each of those and tick off which ones are applicable in parts B and C. And then when you have finished doing it independently, then take a few minutes and talk to each other, and reflecting upon how you were brought up, what impact that may have on your own marriage. So reading at the bottom of page 81, when you finished B and C above, please discuss the following. What did you need to be grateful for? Did you have any unmet childhood needs? Are you aware of these adversely affecting your marriage? Are you aware of benefits to your marriage or family life through imitating your parents or step-parents? Are you aware of ways you adversely affect your marriage? So it'll take, like I say, about 10 minutes for this exercise. Okay, if you will set that aside again, you may want to continue that discussion further on your own time. The next activity we're going to do is called, in the handout we've given you, the 5 love languages. Now, it's really mislabeled, because this is not how you show godly love. So if you'll just kindly take a pen or a pencil and write through the word love and write in the word affection, because it's really about showing your spouse affection and that you care for your spouse. If you want to know how to love your spouse, read the Bible. If you want to know how you can more effectively show to your spouse that you care for them and you have strong affection for them, we're going to do this exercise. So as long as we're clear on this, unbeknownst to me, this Love Languages has sold 10 million copies. It's a religion which I haven't read the book. I'm not recommending you read the book. Now, you can if you want, but the book is not about godly love. The book has got to be about affection, because this is really what affection is what it's based on. But it's important that we learn to show affection to our spouse on a frequent basis, on a daily basis, preferably multiple times during the day. And, you know, the affection can be shown to them through words, through texts, through flowers, through chocolates, through touches and hugs and kisses and intimate conversations, going for a walk hand in hand. There's a lot of different ways we can convey to our spouse that we have a strong affection for them. But it isn't just a feeling. It's helpful to actually demonstrate to them that such is the case. So you have these different ways of being able to express your affection for your spouse, to let them know you are special to me and I am grateful that you are my spouse. And shouldn't surprise us, in the same way that God made man different from woman, you know, how we appreciate being told that someone cares about us by our spouse will vary from person to person. Not all women like to receive flowers. Some do. Not all women like to receive chocolates. Some do. Some women even like to receive chocolate flowers. So it all varies from person to person. And the purpose of this exercise is to just see how it's worthwhile to know how your spouse appreciates being appreciated. And I didn't clear this with head office beforehand, so I'm on thin ice. But I just assumed when I was growing up, because I had observed, you know, I was a pretty smart young man. And I showed up one day after we were married. I wouldn't say I was in the doghouse, but, you know, it's where, whatever the difference is between your house and the doghouse. You know, I needed to apologize and to make up or whatever. And you walk through the door with this bouquet of flowers. And that's when you learn not all women enjoy receiving flowers. So I learned at the School of Hard Knocks. But to her credit, I didn't ask. But, you know, I caught on. I don't bring flowers home anymore. I still have to bring other things, but it's not flowers. So anyways, it's worth finding out what your spouse appreciates. And that is the purpose of this activity. And not all men are the same. You know, they have different interests as well. So what we're going to ask you to do is pull out this sheet. It's been used thousands of times, hundreds of thousands of times, I don't know, but many people have found it helpful. If you find it to be less than that, then we ask you to bear with it. But we would ask you to go through the activity and just see what it produces for you. I don't think it'll be offensive anyway. It's going to ask you a series of questions. You're going to answer the questions. Now, fellas, don't be like I was the first time and you try to read the question. Now, if I answer it this way, what am I going to be like? And, you know, go back. And if I'm going to answer it this way, what am I going to... Don't do that. I've tried that. It doesn't work. You get too confused. And the worst part? You end up in the doghouse. Because your spouse wants to know how you are characterized by answering the questions honestly and truthfully. As they would, you know, I don't blame my spouse for that. So just answer the questions the way they are, where they're given. And there's 30 of them, and then you go back and score them in the bottom left-hand corner of page 2, which also should have affection languages written at the top of your page. And it will tell you if you're the kind of person that best appreciates words of affirmation, quality time, receiving gifts, acts of service, or physical touch. Now, I want to say up front that we shouldn't view this whole subject selfishly. If you're if you get done with this activity, you know, and you turn to your spouse and say, look, my profile tells you that I want you to give me gifts, and we've been home a whole week since the marriage weekend, and you haven't given me a gift, then we have failed in this activity. That's not what this is designed to do. This activity is designed to help your spouse better understand you. So please don't look at the activity selfishly. Please don't expect selfish results from the activity, because that is completely inconsistent with what we have been talking about all week. So don't rush through it. Take your time. Answer the questions. Score yourself, and then the two of you can share your results. Okay, if you'll set that aside. Again, it says five love languages. It's the focus of affection. Don't let it become a source of contention in your relationship. It's designed wholly to aid, not to work in the negative direction. In some cases, you may have equal scores, and that just means, you know, you have lots of opportunity. And don't forget, you can always talk to your spouse, so you can always tell your spouse what you do like and you don't like. This is intended to be we're not trying to make something difficult out of something that should be easy and simple. The last portion of our session, we turn our focus to what the book calls the summer season of marriage. It's for those who have been married for more than just a couple of years. You now have children in your relationship. It becomes a case of juggling responsibilities and demands while still growing your marriage relationship. Life changes when you have kids. It just does. Your priorities change because your world all of a sudden becomes child-centered. You know, for the husbands whose wife used to only have direction and affection and devotion to me, now she's tired all the time because the child is waking up three times a night, and it just changes things. But your free time evaporates because all of a sudden the children take up just about all your time and energy. And they probably take up more time and energy for the first child because you are getting used to what this is all about. You talk to the parents that have three or four children, and by the time the third or fourth child comes along, they've got a bit of, they're well along on the learning curve. But the children can have a drain on your marriage relationship if you're not careful. They can. You know, they can take away all the time and all the energy and the affection. And, you know, it's where you have to be careful to guard your time and your relationship with one another, because your relationship doesn't automatically grow and get boosted because you have children. It can, because, again, in God's wisdom, you know, you want to make a couple who are already close even closer. Bless that relationship with a child to which they now both have to work together to raise that child in a godly home. So having children can be very effective in increasing the oneness of the marriage relationship. But the parents have to be aware of that, and they have to make sure that they are still directing their energies towards one another. So you have to be you have to almost go out of your way to be able to spend time together, because you still have to have the meaningful conversations. You know, they still have to be at the dynamic end of that spectrum. You've got to find an opportunity to talk through the issues. When you have children, it doesn't mean any of the other marital issues all of a sudden disappear. They now just have to be addressed in a relationship that has less time to be able to address them. So you have to make a conscious effort to grow your relationship. If there are children involved, there's usually more ecclesial events that you participate in, and you've got to schedule that into your family time. And so you have to be selective in where you spend your time. You know, you don't put your name on the list of everything going on in the ecclesia, because you won't have time to be able to do all of that and then still spend meaningful time with your family and with your wife. It's not selfish to schedule time for each other. And it's not selfish to tell the ecclesia, I just can't help out with all those things because now I have these additional responsibilities at home. Secondly, you're going to be asked to endure trials and hardships, probably in this summer season of your marriage. It's another area where the strength of your oneness will determine how helpful you are to your spouse. And remember, trials are intended to grow our faith individually, God's wisdom, Hebrews 12, and trials are intended to grow our oneness, our marriage relationship. God doesn't bring difficulties into our marriage to destroy our marriage. He brings difficulties and trials into our marriage to strengthen our marriage, provided we respond the proper way. But during the trial, you need to continue to monitor your marriage relationship. And the trials we're talking about is if, you know, one spouse has a parent, you know, who's dying or who's very sick. And that could become a serious issue for your spouse. So as these trials come along, or maybe, you know, you both have a child who is sick, and that adds a dimension to the family and a source of stress and anxiety to the family that you didn't have before. Or maybe there's something going on in the ecclesia that affects the husband more than the wife. Or maybe someone has left the truth and that affects the husband more than the wife, or the wife more than the husband. Or there's difficulties with somebody else's children and that has an impact on you. So there's all kinds of these issues that begin to affect our relationship, and you can't protect your relationship from these. I mean, the love of Christ says we do what we can to help the sick parent or the straying child or the physically ailing ones in the ecclesia, you know, whatever. We're compelled to go and help them, but as a result of us taking on that additional trial, so to speak, it can have an impact on us. There could be financial problems. So there's any number of problems that could impact us and have a different impact upon one or another of the spouses. And I'll give you a personal example. My mother died in 1986. I was 30 years old. We had been married about 10 years. That word about is helpful. About 10 years. And I'm not looking for anything other than to share this story. She had been sick for about 6 months with cancer, and we knew it was coming. But when the day finally came and she died, you know, you can prepare all you want, but then when the actual event comes, it has an impact. And, the story I like to share is I can remember at the time thinking, because we had three boys at the time. They were probably 10, 8, and 6, and again, I'd missed it by a couple of years. But, it was important for me that the three boys be at the funeral in a suit. Where that came from, I do not know. But I hadn't been to the death of the funeral of my mother ever before, so it was all brand new for me. And it, looking back on it now, it probably didn't make sense. It didn't make sense. All of a sudden, you know, you've now got 3 days to get new suits for the boys. And I'm certain I had not talked about it beforehand. But, you know, Sister Diane was very accommodating, and I think her mother was in town as well, and she assisted. And nobody came up and said, "Now, what are you making this off-the-wall request for?" And it's just an example to show that when we're in the midst of a trial, one spouse may not always think clearly, and you don't question them, you don't try to be logical with them, you just support them, and you do what you can out of love and compassion to help them in the midst of the trial, because it is a difficult time for them. So expect those trials to come along. And don't be alarmed if something comes up and it seems to impact you more than it does your spouse, because each of us deal with these situations differently. So if a trial comes into your marriage and your spouse all of a sudden becomes much less talkative because the way they are trying to cope with whatever sadness or difficulty they're facing, whatever they're wrestling with, their mechanism to cope with it may be to become withdrawn and not talk to people, because they're reflecting and that's where they find the best place to be. So you have to be sympathetic to that, and you have to understand that. That's part of the sensitivity, and it can work husband to wife and wife to husband. But you continue to pray for them, you continue to work with them, but don't be surprised if something comes into your marriage relationship and it impacts one of you more than the other. And if it doesn't seem to be impacting your spouse as much as it's impacting you, it's not because they don't love you as much. It's not because they're insensitive or they're uncaring. They may just deal with it differently than you do. But these are issues you have to be prepared to deal with. And the first time you go through a trial, I think of a similar type situation, you want to be aware, because if you're not, and you don't have the consideration and the compassion and the sensitivity, it can add another layer of difficulty to an already, regrettable in some cases, or difficult situation, or trials that come into our life. So the enduring the trials and the hardships was number two. Number one was juggling the response and the demands, just so you can see where we're going. The last one, if you pull out your handout, that's what I'm going to be referring to, is the family unit. And we'll just spend a couple minutes on this to conclude. But it shouldn't surprise us that if God has designed the marriage relationship to transform his sons and daughters, God has designed the family unit to do the exact same thing. Because God created and designed the marriage relationship, and God created and designed the family unit. Man did not invent the family unit. God did. And you can go through Scripture, just like we did with husbands and wives, and identify all the responsibilities of the fathers and all the responsibilities of the mothers. We spent a few minutes this morning talking about the wonderful role and responsibility a mother has in raising her children. Not that the father doesn't have responsibilities too. But God needs a godly woman involved in the raising of his children in those early formative years to impress upon their young and tender mind his ways. And Psalm 127 tells us they are his children. They're not just our children. And you see the wisdom of God in creating this family unit. He takes a man, a brother, a husband who loves him, loves God, and loves his wife. And he takes a woman, a sister, a wife who loves God and loves her husband, and into that environment, God places his children to be taught his way, to grow up and to learn to love his ways and to embrace his ways and to make God their heavenly father. So all of these pieces tie together. And there are responsibilities for the fathers and for the mothers and for the children. And if everyone will cooperate with those responsibilities, God can save them all. I'll give you one example, and that is the command to honor your father and mother. You say, well, that command is given to the children, right? We'll take a five-year-old aside and say, well, you have to honor your mother and father. I do? What does that mean? So God gives the command to the children, but he gives the responsibility to teach the command to the parents. And then the parents, in God's wisdom, have to live in a way in which the child will grow up in that family and willingly choose to honor mother and father. Because you cannot force anyone to obey God's commands, because you are violating that principle of free will. Yes, you can force a five-year-old to honor their parents. And you can use enough discipline to make sure they do. And maybe at 10 you can do it too. But not at 15. If we are trying to force our children to honor us at 15, the rebellion will be enormous. So what that means is mom and dad have to create an environment in the home Whereas the children are growing up, they want to honor mom and dad because that's not only the right thing to do, but they have come to value that. And because they have learned that mom and dad love them because they want to see them in the kingdom. And everything that mom and dad do has that purpose. So the children grow up willingly embracing and willingly agreeing to obey this command of honoring your father and mother, not because the parents forced it upon them, but because the parents adopted or embraced a way of loving family life that the children would see the value in that. It's incredible how God has designed these things where the mom and dad absolutely have to be living a godly life so that the children will embrace the very principles that God has put them under command to obey. And that's just one indication of how it all ties together. But just as we've seen in the family and the marriage relationship where God doesn't give us commands to make life difficult. He doesn't make us, give us commands so that we feel burdened by these things. He gives us commands because he's trying to save us. And if we will learn to cooperate with those commands, he can save us all. Because those lovely six-month-olds, sorry mothers if I got the ages wrong, but the ones we've seen this weekend, they are born with a sin-prone nature that is only going to get worse. So what do they need with their sin-prone nature? They need two God-fearing, loving individuals who are devoted to God's ways. That's what they need. So that those two parents can not only love the child, but teach the child about that sin-prone nature. So that as that child grows up, the child will learn to deal with their nature, age appropriate, in a way that they will not only come to grips with it, but they will come to see that is the real enemy of God. And that sin-prone nature is what must be made subject to the principles of God. And they will do it willingly because within that home has been created an environment where God's principles are highly revered and respected. Not because people are forced, because you can force 5-year-olds, you cannot force 15-year-olds. But it is wonderful how God has designed this. And it isn't just the children who benefit spiritually. By mom and dad having to devote themselves to God's ways, in the end, God can save mom and dad. Because in this day and age, brethren and sisters, that world is so evil that if our children grow up and they see that mom and dad have more than one focus in life, sometimes God is important, sometimes this is important, sometimes this is important, and mom and dad have this divided heart. And sometimes we attend the ecclesial functions and we're strongly supportive there, and other times we don't because we have these other things we're pursuing. It's terribly confusing for the kids. Terribly confusing. So God places the responsibility for the raising of these children upon the parents, and it's critical as parents that we be single-hearted in our devotion to God. It doesn't mean we're not involved in other things and we have employment responsibilities and but it does mean our children know always, always, that mom and dad are not just serious in their talking about God, they are genuine in their devotion to God. One of the recommendations we have is that you establish in your home that you are a kingdom-heading family. And it's in the notes, so you can review it afterwards. In my mind, this can be an overarching theme for all families, because it's a theme that the youngest child can understand. If the child's 2, maybe you draw the picture and you put it on the fridge. So you see that? That's where we're heading. When they get to be 6 or 7, you can have them draw the picture of the kingdom in whichever way they want. and you put it on the fridge and you display it. But it has an age appropriateness all the way along. And it helps to explain why we do things and why we don't do things. Other families in the world, they may do that, and they may go there, and they may participate in that, but we don't. Because we are a kingdom-heading family. And 4 and 5-year-olds can understand what that means. They may not understand all the complexities, but they understand that the kingdom is important in this family. How we treat each other comes under this same umbrella. There are things we do for each other, and there are things we don't do for each other, because we are a kingdom-heading family. And it can be very effective, and it's something that, you know, is true for a 5-year-old, and it's true for a 15-year-old. You can have those discussions when the children are very young, and you can have those discussions when the children get to the teen years. You know, the example I like to use is your 12-year-old comes and shows your mom, here's this picture of this bikini I want to buy for this summer. Where did that come from? She doesn't call it a bikini. She just says, Mom, don't you like this swimsuit? And you're thinking, where did that even come from? And then you have to have those discussions about modesty. And I'm not looking to offend anyone. I saw some views like, whoa, maybe I shouldn't have used that word. But, you know, I think all mothers and fathers have to come to grips with bikinis or whatever it is, you know, that immodest, you know, dress. And then you have the discussion. Well, your father doesn't like that. That doesn't work. Maybe it does when the first time you have it. But you see, when that discussion takes place under the umbrella or within the arena of, that's not what we wear, because we're heading to the kingdom. You know, or your sons, whatever the issue is, that's not where we go, because we're heading to the kingdom. They may not always like it, but they can see that mom and dad didn't have standards in the home based on dad's whims or quips. And mom says, well, that's what my grandmother always said, so that's what we're going to... It's none of that. The Bible becomes the focus and the center of the family. And all that we do is based on Scripture, because we are heading to the kingdom. And when they are 18 or 20 or whatever it is, 25, when they finally leave their home, you know, and you have to say goodbye, and they go out your door, they are heading to the kingdom so that they can raise their own children, not that we think Christ will be away that long, to be kingdom-heading family themselves. So I know you won't find a verse that probably supports this by itself, but I think when you take the collective counsel of Scripture, have a clear definition for your children about the direction you're heading. And we have found that this concept of being a kingdom-heading family can be very, very helpful. The last point is the single overriding principle pertaining to parenting, and it's not surprising. If we want to raise a godly seed, we must be living a godly life. There's no shortcuts to that. You can't make up for that. You can't sacrifice your own living of a godly life and then turn around and expect to be able to raise your children in a way that they will grow up to embrace God and His principles and His future. So being a good parent starts with being a good disciple. The absolute best thing we can do for our children is to live the truth ourselves and showing them that God's ways are the right way to live. Our children must see that we reverence God in how we live, that the kingdom is the most important thing in our life. The Bible is special. Christ is special. The ecclesia is special. Prayer is special. That we love by putting others' needs first. And sharing the truth with others is our responsibility, because as God is saving us, we should be looking to save others. When our children see us living the truth, it becomes alive for them. It isn't just words on a paper. It isn't just something they hear in a Sunday school or in an exhortation or a Bible class. The truth comes alive. In God's wisdom, children become a motivator for parents' right conduct, and they restrain parents from wrong conduct. And in the end, you ask the question, who is saving whom? And it's marvelous how this works. Parents adopt and embrace God's principles, and they put them in practice for the sake of their children. And you turn around and you ask yourself, well, who is saving whom here? Is it the parents saving the kids, or the kids saving the parents? I'll give you one example. and then we'll conclude. But you know, you have the mother at home, and there's the 3-year-old daughter, and the mother's been having a difficult day, and things have been going wrong, and then something else happens, and the mother has this outburst of anger or whatever it is, and the 3-year-old sees that. And, you know, and the mother, that wasn't good. She didn't see that. So the mother sits down with the 3-year-old on the couch, you know, and says, you know, mom made a mistake, and she's apologizing to the 3-year-old. And then the mom stops and she says, why am I apologizing to a 3-year-old? And it's right that she do that, because the 3-year-old saw a behavior that was inconsistent with the principles of God. So at the age of 3, that child is now helping save the mother, because the mother knows she has to uphold God's principles in their home. And when she deviates from those principles, she has to be prepared to point out to her child that I made a mistake. That's not how we talk. That's not how we react. This is what's right. I have to acknowledge to God that I was wrong. He will forgive me, and on we go. But it's a wonderful, wonderful relationship that God creates within our homes if we follow his principles. And if we will cooperate with them, in the end, he can save us all. The mom, the dads, and the kids. Nobody can be forced. But if they will willingly embrace those principles, they can all be saved. So I wanted to just conclude by expressing my personal appreciation for the weekend. And I think that includes the Okanagan brethren, that it includes those who have, you know, helped behind the scenes. But really what's at most at stake, I think, is the need for each of us, you know, Sister Diane and myself included, to really come to grips with what these principles are. I should share with you that we had decided last week that once this trip was done, we're hoping, God willing, in the next month or so to find a place and go away for 2 days, and we're going to do our own exercises. We've done them before, but, you know, there's never a wrong time to be having these communication over issues that we need to get right in our marriages, not just so that we can glorify God, but so that we can build the strongest possible oneness in our relationship that can be so helpful to God in the transformation process.